This is the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means on May the 20th, and we have some work session work to do first. We have a federal grant, and Mr. Wilson, why don't you explain that for us, and then we'll go to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and there is someone from the agency if questions come up on this federal grant. This is a grant that was brought to us just in the past few days. It was announced by the federal government, Department of Labor, I think on May 11th. We got it a couple days after, and it is due, actually, I believe, today, the application. It was a very quick turnaround, so if we get it, we'll meet the deadlines if we get it through this subcommittee into the full on Friday. We'll be pretty close to the deadlines. This is a grant from the U.S. Department of Labor. The Community Colleges and Workforce Development Department is applying for it, the Workforce Development part of the department. It is a transition activities grant relating to the new workforce law, the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act, which was passed last year, and the effective date of that new law is July 1, 2015. The funds can be used for a variety of purposes, training frontline staff, bringing together program officials and stakeholders for strategic planning, both at the local and state level, various transition costs that may be incurred as part of the change in the federal law, and some transitioning of programming because the new law requires 75% of the funds that are designated for youth be spent on out-of-school youth, which is different than the current federal law. So, and also you can use it for information systems upgrades and improvements related to that law. So the department is asking for authority to apply for a federal grant in the amount of $168,417. The funny number is mainly due, it's an allocation formula. If a state does apply, they automatically get that amount. So that for is a presentation.
I will open a work session on the federal grant application. Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair, I move that we approve the request from the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development.
Okay, questions? Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So, Doug, this is literally all you have to do is actually fill out some paperwork, and then the grant's ours.
Basically and simplistically, that is right, Madam Co-Chair. My guess is it does take some explaining in how you plan to use the funds, but.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, the motion is to approve the request for a Community College and Workforce Development federal grant application in the amount of $168,417. Any further discussion? Is there any objections to the motion? Okay. And we need a carrier to full waste,
just full,
right?
I'm fine.
Senator Roblin will carry to full.
He needs to do something in there other than just watch Senator Devlin and Senate.
It's nice when you're down in the kids' seats. You have a good view of everybody, and so it would be nice to do something. They've been nice to Hansel. He's carried a lot. So.
Our front row member of Full Ways and Means will carry it. Okay, with that, I will open a work session on House Bill 3499. Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, this is a bill that comes from you from the House Education Committee. Some background. This is a bill that applies to English language learners and sets up a new program within the Department of Education. If you remember in the state school fund bill that passed out of this subcommittee many days ago, there were two distributions created, or sometimes referred to as carve-out. One was about for between 2 and 3 million for nutrition programs, and the second one was 12.5 million for these English language learners or ELL program. So that is the funding mechanism for this bill. There is an amendment to this bill because the policy bill does create a permanent carve-out. The state school fund bill, because it's a 5,000 series bill, can only do that for once. So the amendment strips that language, one-time language, out of the state school fund bill, which is now chapter 5 or 25 of Oregon laws. And that's all the amendment does. What the bill itself does, it passed out of education. It sets up the program. It creates two work groups or advisory groups. The first is to sort of quickly come up with a set of uniform budget coding requirements to sort of get the core reporting requirements out to school districts. That work has to be completed by September of 2015, I believe. And then the state school board or the state board of education has to pass that, their view of that work on as a rule. The second work group is a little more extensive. They have to identify criteria for determining if districts meet objectives and needs of ELL students. They identify the core information necessary for district reporting and other reporting requirements, guidelines for that reporting, and then also look at technical assistance. The bill also requires that a plan be created for the ELL program and then set up the program for the $12.5 million distribution that will first be used to hire two staff, education specialists, support the work groups, develop the plan, work on technical assistance with the agencies. We will put the numbers for that in the ODE budget as it comes through the subcommittee later in session. Other funds will be used to probably identify between 30 and 35 schools. That's an estimate that need a lot more work in this area. There'll be grants to those schools, and then also money will flow to most districts for implementing the statewide plan and other services around ELL programs. So that's the use of the 12.5. So, Mr. Chair, with that description of the bill, I'll stand for any questions. If there are too complicated, we'll have to probably run and get the committee staff to do
other help. Questions for Mr. Wilson, Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to confirm, Doug, that it'll be grant. It will not be a competitive grant structure. It will be a designation of high need districts, and they will get those grants.
That is my understanding, Mr. Chair, Representative Smith Warner, and I think the department and their, if not the the advisor group, is the ones that determine the criteria for selecting those, and then the department will select those lower performing districts/schools.
Okay, thank you,
Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and you know, we had a great conversation yesterday around immersion programs, and I see those as even better than just the ELL program. So will some of this and will the conversation include, because as I read the bill, I didn't see that it could or would it include the conversations about dual immersion programs and other kinds of programs that would enhance your already work that you're doing with ELL students outside of the classroom?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roblin, I'm not sure. I don't think it's addressed in the bill. I'm not sure if someone from the agency
can. We have somebody from the agency that?
That
can answer the question. Yep. Here she comes.
Thank you, Cindy.
Got it. Okay. Good morning, Co-Chairs Monroe and Kopp. LFO staff is exactly correct. It's not specifically
on
addressed in the bill.
On your name on the record.
Oh, Cindy Hunt, Government and Legal Affairs Manager. I think after all these years, I'd get it down.
Thanks, Cindy.
So Mr. Wilson is exactly correct. It's not identified in the bill. However, the discussion definitely with the House Education Committee and around the bill was that because the districts will be reporting in on how much money they're expending on ELL programs, there's the advisory groups that are ongoing, that discussions about best practices around ELL programs will also very much be part of the discussion. And also part of the vision for this is when we roll out the state ELL plan, you know, dual immersion programs are definitely, you know, kind of envisioned and incorporated and that kind of thing.
Okay.
So,
okay.
That
yeah.
makes me happy.
Other question? Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to comment first. Okay, Rob doesn't have tomatoes or anything in his hand, so I'll duck down when I say it feels. No, I'm going to support it, and because I support the work group, I'm saddened that we couldn't actually get something done this session I think there were a lot of good ideas. I know Representative Wisnett had some good ideas around ELL. I really don't care that we had already appropriated the $12.5 million, because I think there's plenty of money that goes into ELL that the work could have been done outside of that. It's just my opinion. Easy for me to say because I don't run the department, but I am supporting of getting answers and trying to correct what I think a lot of folks think need to be some changes within the system.
Okay. Additional discussion or questions? Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The comment that I would make is this is, it looks more simple than it really is. And when you are looking at the needs for ELL students, it's been my experience that we look at the dual language immersion programs and we all mostly relate that to elementary students. But when you have a 15-year-old that comes from another country, only has their native language, and our statutes still do require or ask that students graduate in 5 years, but when you have that 15-year-old and how you're going to meet their needs to learn a second language plus learn the content that you're going to need to be what we're asking, ready for college, this it is very challenging. And so I'm sure this group will, it's going to be well used, and many of our schools are just finding the new influx of non-English speakers. This is their first time with a lot of these students, so it's very important.
Senator Roblin.
Yeah, I just want to say that I absolutely agree with what was just said, and the fact that you know, a lot of people think there's a lot of extra money out there because we have waiting in the formula for ELL and some other kinds of things. The reality is that's a distribution formula, and districts have to use it in different ways. It's not allocated especially for this. I think this is a nice, elegant way of getting some money and to really start dealing with the issues in the districts. I want to look at this more closely because I think this may be the same reason we can do for STEM and other kinds of things when you can do some stuff to help those programs. I didn't like an adjustment in the formula, but I do like an idea that says outside money that we expect you to tell us what you're going to do and expect us to have a report afterwards of how you did it are ways in which you can target money to programs which we all really care about. And this one, I think, is good. I would love to see a similar kind of concept around STEM and around some of the technical stuff that we're looking at so that we can keep the programs going, we can show that we're making it happen and maybe increase the development there. So I want to watch this really closely over the next year or so and see if it's a good avenue to have conversations about others that take the formula out, because I think the formula, as everybody that has ever had to work with the formula knows, anytime you tweak it any one way or another, it creates a different kind of display of stuff. And I think
just like squeezing a balloon.
So we can really get into what is helping these programs advance in some of these schools that have had trouble. So, yeah, thank you.
I think it would be appropriate for us to ask next February maybe for a report on how this is developing.
I think it was
Cindy,
in
maybe
there.
You could make sure that happens when we meet again next February for the short session. Okay, what we need now is a motion on the A4 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair, I move the dash A4 amendments to the House Bill 3499.
Mr. Chair, if I can explain the amendment, because a couple of people stepped in later. This amendment, as I noted before, the state school fund bill included a one-time carve-out or distribution of $12.5 million for this program. The bill itself has a permanent carve-out in it, so the amendment does nothing more than take that carve-out, one-time carve-out, out of the state school fund bill language that is already in statute because that bill has been signed by the governor.
Okay.
And it is slightly different language. It's less detailed, but the appropriations and the ways and means process will be the ones that will finally decide how the money is generally spent anyway. So later this session when we do the ODE budget, you'll be figuring out how much goes for grant and aid and how much goes for operations and technical assistance.
Discussion on the motion. Any objections to the motion? The A4 are adopted. Madam Co-Chair?
Yes. Mr. Co-Chair, I move that House Bill 3499 moves to the full Committee of Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, the motion is to send 3499 to full Ways and Means as amended with a due pass recommendation. Discussion of the motion. Any objections to the motion? Okay, now we need carriers to full Ways and Means to the floor of the House and to the Senate. Madam Co-Chair?
Yes, I would love to carry this bill.
Okay. Madam Co-Chair will carry to full Ways and Means and to the House and to the Senate. Senator Roblin will carry to the Senate. Okay, 3499 is adopted, and it's time for us to reopen our discussions with Department of Education and Mr. Saxon. So I would open public hearing once again on House Bill 5016. I didn't do that? Oh, well, okay. I'll close 3499 and open a public hearing on 5016. Good thing, you know, I feel like Moses up here just leaning on my staff.
Good morning,
Mr. Saxon.
Members of the committee, for the record, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction, Rob Saxon. It's a pleasure to be here today. Senator Roblin, thank you for the memo today on the light gray and blue and our presentation there. And I do have some questions to answer from yesterday.
I thought it was pink day.
One of those was regarding, is it possible to get the amounts of strategic investments on a per ADMW basis by county? I have those today by school district as opposed to by county, but if you take a look at the sheet here, it's sort of an odd one, although I enjoyed looking at it, to be honest with you, on the amount per student. It's a little bit awkward because we didn't really allocate all the funds on a per student basis. I mean, that's just not how they went out. And what you'll see is that it looks like small school districts got a lot on a per student basis. As a superintendent in a school district, quite frankly, we used to have a rule that if dollars offered by the state weren't of a certain amount, that we probably would not accept them because it took us longer to track them and account for them and report back on them than it was worth the take. And we set that somewhere around $2,500 to $5,000, depending on the proclivities of the business manager that I was working with and whether or not I could force them to accept dollars. When I think about that, having a certain amount is really important in order to guide these things. And so one of the things that we did when we allocated these resources was in really small school districts, we set a floor or we set something in the formula about how they were going to receive those dollars so that it made it reasonable for them to accept those dollars. So when you look at the Adel school district with 6.24 students and $6,400, it looks like a lot of money, right? $1,025 per student. But if we bump out to, the Bend Lapine School District with 37,000 students, $25 per student, and $965,000 overall, that looks a little bit different. And if you go through this, that's kind of what you see. The second question that we had was around the Eastern Promise, and do universities recognize students? And yes. The answer is that four-year public institutions accepted the credits in the student's major course of study. Private institutions tended to accept credit at minimum for students' general election education requirements, and not all were accepted in the student's chosen course of study. So, yes, universally, the credits have been accepted is sort of the short answer. And then lastly, and I also enjoyed finding out the answer to this question. It was one of those that sort of had me do a double take because the data is so strong. And it is, with the Eastern Promise, what percent of students are requiring remediation when they matriculate onto college? 19%. 81% do not need to take remediation once they've been accredited in the content area that they, in which they have participated. That's really different than 75% needing to take remediation who matriculate to community college within 2 years of graduation at high school. Those participating in Eastern Promise, 81% do not need to participate in developmental ed. It's pretty remarkable. Now, in talking to Mark Mulvihill, the superintendent of the ESD out there that's coordinated all this work, he says that's, you know, a year's data, and we need to really dig in the next year or two to make sure that that's not some kind of an anomaly, but it certainly looks good to start with.
I'm co-chair.
Mr. Chair, would you mind repeating the numbers that Mr. Saxon just said? I noticed that several people in the back row had a little bit of hard time hearing the numbers. That's a teacher's observation. So could you just restate them?
Mr. Saxon, would you state those numbers again?
A little.
81% did not require remediation who participated in Eastern Promise.
That came through Eastern Promise. So 19% had to do remedial work, whereas those that didn't go through Eastern Promise, 75% needed some kind of remedial work.
Correct, sir.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you.
Just because I like it's my math doesn't allow me to not say this. It's also important to figure out it's a self-selecting group that takes Eastern Promise. And then, so therefore, you have to go back and look of the 70% that have to get remediation. How many of those would have been people who would have had to be in remediation before it? Because if all the people that were taking Eastern Promise were from the group that didn't need it, might be showing us that we did less. They didn't do as well. So, I mean, I just want to make sure when we come up with numbers that we look at the real data to figure out, did it make an effect on the people who we want it to make an effect on, i.e. those people who were needing remediation? And it just, I can't help myself. I'm sorry. Took too much statistics and stuff in school to understand. So numbers about themselves do not deeply get into answering the questions that we need to answer. I love the outcome. I just need to figure out, is that outcome a change or not? And that takes a little deeper understanding.
So. And what the senator is saying is there are lies, damn lies, and statistics.
Just so I know.
Co-Chair Monroe, thank you for saying that.
I always blew out everybody else's candles at this. That's right. I did do that.
It's quite true. All right. I was at slide 50. And if, with the permission of the committee, I would proceed from there. And we'll complete this today, I think. So slide 50 was about culturally responsive pedagogy and practices grant. And this was a $2 million grant. It was awarded to post-secondary institutions, school districts, and CBOs. And the intent really was to provide staff development and learning for educators, which would help them teach and interact in a more culturally responsive way. So one of the things that I came to realize fairly late in my career was that you can teach. The question is, are people learning? And we all have a context in this world. And when we can teach from something that people already understand, the leap to the next understanding is really simple. And so if our background is different, if the way that we engage in the world or the experiences that we've had is different, a context that someone provides may not speak to us, and then we can't make that leap. And so one of the things that we're working really hard with this kind of a grant opportunity is to provide training for people to say, please think about the cultural context within which you're teaching and tie things together so that all kids in your classroom, not just some, can respond to the cultural context that you're talking about and make the leap to the new learning. And so being specific about that and using the resource to provide training around that with educators is a really valuable thing and helps close achievement gaps in a different way than we've experienced before. So the point certainly was to increase academic achievement, retention, and graduation rates for students of color, and to increase support for applying and enrolling in four-year colleges and universities. So wrapped all that together, there's a little bit more to it, but I would leave it at that and move on to the next. Slide 51 is about the English Language Proficiency Standards Professional Development Grant. So we developed new English language proficiency standards in the state of Oregon, and really it was because we have a new set of standards for all kids, the Common Core. We needed to make sure that our English language proficiency standards align to that set of standards, and once you do that, we need to provide support to people so that they can teach to that set of standards. We did that with the Common Core, and therefore we also need to do it with teachers who are working largely with the English language proficiency standards toward the Common Core. So that's what this grant was about. It's a fairly small grant at $700,000. It was awarded to 37 school districts, and it was those school districts that had at least 300 ELL students or at least 15% of their student population were ELL. So if you had a small district, as long as you had at least 15% ELL, then there were some resources for your teachers to get some support around this. And then on top of that, because it worries me when we're only advantaging districts that have certain kinds of student populations or certain numbers of student populations, we also developed this out of that. And this is like one of the things sort of crazy that pops up out of this kind of work that I was that I'm immensely proud of, and yet the work that I did on it personally is almost zero, right? But the work that our staff did on it and others did on it is really impressive. This is a massive online open course, a MOOC. It took me a little while to figure out what that was. So a MOOC.
I thought it was a monk.
A what?
It's a monk.
That's a MOOC.
Okay.
Anyway, so it's a MOOC. Yeah, don't get me going. It's a MOOC, and basically this is a course that was developed by a Dr. Kenji Hokuda, who is a professor out of Stanford, and Dr. Karen Thompson, who's a professor at Oregon State, both in the area of specialty of around language acquisition and language use. And they developed this so that anyone in the state could go online, access this course, learn to what the new English language proficiency standards were, and learn pedagogy, teaching methodology, about how to teach to that set of standards. It is an incredibly rich course. We had 473 teachers who took advantage in the state of Oregon of that. There's Karen Thompson, Kenji Okuda, and Sarah Rutherford from the graduate school at Stanford who developed the course. There were, I think, about 1,500 people worldwide, which I think is interesting, right? 473 teachers in the state of Oregon, almost 1,500 educators worldwide who took this course from this group of people, and that you could get credit if you paid for the credit. And it was a really neat opportunity. That course is being repeated, and I think it started yesterday, if I recall, or it's starting about now, so that people can take that course. And it's now a resource that we have where people can take it and have access to that. So a really neat way to use those resources.
I just want to say, I think the C is sounded as an S in this one, and Tillamook County really loves MOOCs.
Yes.
If you're going to change it to a different name, we're going to change it to MOOCs.
So it's Co-Chair Monroe. I can't resist. I think you ought to just switch it to Coos.
Okay, that'd work out.
Okay.
Oh, Coos.
But I like Tillamook, too, and our cows are important to us.
As a Coos County native. Okay.
Okay, back to teaching the lesson.
American Indian and Alaska Native Culturally Relevant Teaching, Learning, and Pedagogy Grant. So I just went on at great length about pedagogy. And about pedagogy is a word that we like to use because it sounds fancy, and it really just means how you go about teaching in a smart way, right? What's your teaching methodology? So if you hear me say that, I apologize. And this is a pedagogy grant. It was $850,000, and it went to all 9 tribes in partnerships with local school districts. And it was development of teaching practices that would speak to the Native American students who attend schools in those districts and are members of those tribes, and also be expansive to all Alaska Native American Indian students across the state who are attending schools, because once this is developed, we can spread it out in other places, and I'll talk about the holding receptacle for some of that work here in a little bit. But really created that partnership, and you can see the different approaches that were used around that. So some of it was around very specific things like college and career readiness support, high school credit recovery, on track for graduation, and accurate American Indian Alaska Native instruction. And the work that was done here, again, very, very good work that I'm quite excited about.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Senator Roebland, then Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you.
I hope that we are sharing this information. You know, we passed a bill last session with regard to mascots, and part of the conversation is that with local tribes we're going to have conversations about how we teach in our education. This would be great information, with especially the accurate information for the curriculum for those schools that are trying to make those arrangements. So I really appreciate this work.
Co-Chairs Conference Monroe, Senator Roebland, thank you for that comment. And yes, I'll talk in a little bit about, maybe I can just do it now and then I don't need to cover it when I get there, that we have built in partnership with Willamette ESD what really is the network for quality teaching and learning, and it is an online receptacle for the kind of product that's developed here that then on July 1 goes live, and we'll have access to educators across the state, and all these different things that we've been producing will be held there in that spot so that teachers can go and get it and use it. And so that would be one of the products that we would have. Once in a while I get things that come across my office. Just quick story, I'm reminded of recently having a call from a Native American grandmother who was very upset because their child had been taught in class that Ms. Pittman, and I'm not going to come up with her first name, was the first woman west of the Rockies. And of course, I don't think that anybody meant necessarily to say that, but it's offensive to think that she was the first woman west of the Rockies. And so being more thoughtful about how we think about things and say things is important, and this gives us an opportunity.
About like Columbus discovering America.
Exactly.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Rob, I promised I wouldn't pick on you yesterday, so it's your turn today. I'm curious because with the strategic initiatives in particular, we have very clear outcomes, and you highlighted it a little bit, or Doug did, and looking at the coding so that we have the accuracy in numbers. First part of my question is, how did you come up with the current numbers, or how are you going to ensure, and I know you're leaving your position, but to ensure that the department is valid and reliable with the numbers in research terms? Yeah, and you can get back to me, but when we're dealing with these numbers, as the good senator pointed out, you can make numbers say a lot of different things from a lot of different angles. So, and I haven't talked to Dr. Golden about this, about how we're going to really keep our outcomes so that, well, so that we're not giving false hope or misguiding school districts in certain ways. And right. And it alludes to what both of our senators said, because, yeah, and I don't remember the quote from Senator Monroe, but I've heard it a lot. But, again, here we have 0.85 million awarded. That's pretty clear. How many districts, and yet I'd guess that student numbers may be up or down, and the same with the educators. So you'd get different percentages for different numbers. So anyway, it's just processing in my head.
And Co-Chair Comp, I appreciate the question. And, you know, when I sit in front of you and we ask for the really large sums of money that we're talking about today, having good information is extremely important. And I talked a little bit yesterday about how important it has been for us as a department to be credible in all that we've done around this, meeting timelines, putting out information as quickly as possible, getting back to people with whether or not they're awarded with a grant, and then monitoring what's happening in a really close way. And so it's very important to us to do that. I also think it's important to educators and community-based organizations and other providers across the state that we do that, because there's opportunity in the dollars that we're talking about for all of those organizations in serving kids. And at the end of the day, the question is, are you moving outcomes with students? I mean, the rest of it really is sort of just fluff, right? I mean, who got it or how it worked, whatever. My question is, are we going to close achievement gap for Native American students because we've had this grant? And I do believe that when a student sits in a classroom and they hear themselves in the instruction, and they can tie their understanding of the way the world works to the instruction that they hear and build new context off of it, that we have an opportunity for additional learning, success in school, and better outcomes for kids. We need our Native American kids to graduate at a higher rate than they do. They're the lowest in the four-year cohort rate of any other subpopulation in the state, period, by about 3% below African American. And these kinds of efforts, especially in coordination with the tribes, have been very strong. the proof in the pudding is going to be, do we start to see these students graduate at a higher rate? And we don't have that data yet.
Right.
This was implemented about, I think, about just earlier than, it's been about a year and a little bit, right? And so to see what happens with that is going to take some time. And yet the building of the material so that all school districts can use it, it's really good.
And the budget that Representative Comp and I are working on with the co-chairs and with the governor's people includes some significant dollars.
Absolutely.
To attack this program. We don't want to leave any kids behind, whether they're Native American, African American, Latino, white, or whatever. We want a system that meets the needs of all of our students.
Thank you, Co-Chair Monroe. And one of the things that plays in my head often is that we made a stated goal. I started with this yesterday, 40-40-20. And we all know it adds to 100. And we cannot leave these kids behind if we're going to achieve 100. And it is even though it's sort of this thing that we know is aspirational, it's a policy driver about how we think about the work that we have to do. You can't get to 100 unless you meet the needs of every. So with that, I'll hope I can go to slide 55, which is another similar kind of grant, but around African-American students, $800,000. These dollars largely went to CBOs and partnerships with school districts, and it created a partnership between those groups in support of African-American students. And the grants focused on parent involvement, literacy instruction, professional development, and innovative programs. The parental involvement component of a number of these is extremely important. We have parents who have not felt invited into schools and have not felt entitled or empowered to be engaged in their child's education. And we've got to change that if we're going to get to the 40-40-20. Great story the other day about a mom, Latino mom, taking her child to school for the first time, six children out in East County. And in a review of a conversation about taking her child to kindergarten for the first day, she said, as I was walking to school, it made me think about what it must have felt like when people stepped on the moon for the first time. That's what it felt like as I was walking my child to school.
Wow.
That's a pretty incredible statement about sort of the intrepidation that somebody can feel when they don't feel invited into an environment that they know something about. We're about to step into an environment where I don't feel invited, and no one like me has ever tread before. It's an interesting comment. It's part of why this is really important.
It's one of the reasons why the Head Start program is so successful, is because of the heavily involvement of parents.
Exactly true. So shifting gears now to delivering the Common Core state standards and educator effectiveness funds. This was a huge piece of work. I probably have said I'm proud of something too often, and when you say that too often, pretty soon it doesn't have any significance. But, you know, we had really two significant changes facing educators in 2013. The first was the adoption of the Common Core. And you'll remember that the State Board adopted the Common Core in 2010, and some districts worked immediately on implementation, but there was still a lot of work to do for even those districts. And then students would be taking a Common Core aligned assessment for the first time in the spring of 2015. And so districts and educators who maybe hadn't embraced teaching to that set of standards yet were highly motivated in the last 2 years to get there, because there was going to be an assessment that measured their success against that. And then the second big one was the passage of Senate Bill 990, which promised a new educator evaluation method as part of our waiver. So we promised to the federal government that we were going to look at evaluation differently, and that evaluation would be done on a statewide basis. Something that if those of you on education committees would like to have me come in and present on sometime, I'd be happy to. What our new evaluation system looks like in the state. And we needed the finished design of the evaluation model, teach people to use it, and then support them in doing it with high quality starting in 2013, because implementation was on the line. And it was a really important effort. And at the time, assessment outcomes were also tied to the evaluation. And so what students' assessment results were going to look like were tied up in the evaluation. Now, they're not for the results for this year, but they technically still are for the following year. And so I don't know how that's all going to turn out exactly, but I think that probably is an error. We shouldn't do that, but we'll see what happens with the reauthorization of the Elementary Secondary Education Act at the federal level and figure that out down the road. So we tied the two together in our professional development offerings across the state, and we partnered with COSA and Chalkboard in the development. We did the delivery. I was very, very nervous about it. For us to say, and we did say this to school districts, we're going to give you some dollars on a per ADMW basis. It was about $6.5 million. I'll show you the number here in just a second. And if you want these dollars, you can have them, but you must come to our professional development before we give them to you. You better have a really good professional development when you leverage things like that. And so I was really nervous about it. And the reports on our first one from us internally was it was really, really good. And reports from people who attended was, it was okay. And by the end, we got to a place where we agreed that they were good and the attendees agreed that they were really good. And in fact, as we move forward in the next biennium, we have fewer dollars to do this, but we believe that people will come simply because they're of high quality. And so that's a bold thing to state. I would want you to see the dollars that went out across the state and where they went. So virtually everyone got them. We divided up into rural, town, city, suburb, and so forth. Virtually everyone received them. And again, we worked on educator effectiveness and the Common Core state standards. Those two things are impossibly tied together. You can't evaluate someone unless you can tell if they're teaching to standards or not. And so we just tied them together and took both pots of money and ran this. The different people who attended, I'm really pleased to see that the majority of people who attended these trainings were teachers. Administrators at 33%, and then you can sort of see the different breakouts of teacher on special assignment. That's what a TOSA means. It's somebody who has typically a content expert at the district level that supports teachers in like good math teaching or good reading teaching. Instructional coaches really are the same, mentors and others. And then some of the things that people said about it, but I want to cover some of the things that people said about attending the workshops. But really, what happened is that teams of teachers and administrators attended from across the state. We basically said that the way that this whole thing worked was you're going to come and attend. You need to attend three workshops in the first year and three workshops in the second year. You need to send a team from your district that's made up of teachers, administrators, TOSAs, who are going to come and receive this professional development in hopefully a really rich way, and then go back to the local district and provide a train-the-trainer model. So you're going to go back and you're going to provide the same kind of support and professional development that you just received in this workshop back in your district, and we're going to send money on through to you so you can buy the substitute time or pay people for time in the summer, which is really preferable, right, because we're not missing teaching time in the summer to come and receive this professional development. And that's how we're going to scale this up, both what the evaluation piece looks like and the teaching to a new set of standards. So I'm going to play, I think, for just a second, if you'll permit me, a very quick video, and I promise I'll only make it play for about 2 minutes, of some of the things that people said that we were able to catch as a result of these professional development opportunities.
We're not reinventing the wheel anymore as teachers who teach by ourselves in our own rooms. We are collaborating as a state, and I'm really excited to see the work that other districts are doing and to try the work that other districts are doing with my students.
It's not very often, you know, when you're teaching on a campus, you're with kids all day long. You don't get a lot of collaboration time. But here you get a couple days to come down, meet people of like mind, share ideas, and then you take those things back to your classroom and you try them out.
We find that we're able to collaborate vertically as well, because administrators, teachers, and all job titles attend this conference. It's not just a teacher conference per se. So we have a lot of lenses and a lot of different perspectives to collaborate on and take all that back to the district. And we create trainings based upon what we have here. We are able to better support our teachers based on what we get from here. So it's fantastic.
I really believe that in our district it's been powerful having both teachers and administrators, you know, sitting next to each other and collaborating on this stuff together. So we've built some capacity for teacher leadership in that way.
Being a small district and being able to come here and meet with other small districts, but also bigger districts that are before us in this process is huge.
I teach at a school where I'm really the only person who wears the hat that I have. I'm the only physical science teacher in my position. It gives me a chance to meet with other teachers in similar situations and talk about what's working and what's not working.
Our district is viewing the Common Core as a promise to kids, a promise to bring the best teaching we possibly can, effective teaching, as well as instruction that will better prepare them with 21st century skills to thrive in our global economy.
All right. Nanette, the last one, was the Oregon Teacher of the Year last year. She's incredible. So I'll not make you watch too much of that, although I enjoyed the whole thing. So we did regional workshops. So Eugene, Portland, LeGrand, three different workshops in three different locations in year one, three different locations, three different workshops in year two. So six overall, 18 different presentations, 18 different opportunities of presentations. We funneled, it was 6.9 million, I said 6.5 a minute ago, 6.9 million through to school districts on an ADMW basis. So for small school districts, they got a little bit extra. The total reimbursement to districts for coming to the actual workshops was about 800,000. So to hold those and take the time from people in the districts cost about 800,000 over 2 years. Like I said, 18 different workshops. And then $877,000 for us to physically put them on, to rent the space, to have the projectors, provide lunch, that kind of thing. We had, again, we were allocating money to some of the smaller school districts on an ADMW basis. It wasn't enough to make a difference. So there was $1 million that was awarded to 127 of the smaller school districts. And some of those chose to combine their resources into co-ops and work together on this, which was really nice and smart. Okay. Shifting again, the expanded reading grant. The expanding reading grant was $4 million. It went to the 68 focus and priority schools. So we had focus and priority schools. I've talked about them quite a bit, and I'll talk about them some more today. And one of the things that was decided out of the last session was that there would be this $4 million that could go to these schools so that they could have extended instructional time, either after school time or summertime or before school. They could also use it to hire additional adult educators, so it could be a teacher or an education assistant, and then also technology to support students in being stronger readers at our focus and priority schools. A number of those schools reported gains in third grade reading. The average increase was 9.5% of students reading at grade level in third grade. Some experienced significant gain and some less significant, but the fact that we're making progress was really nice. What we found, too, quite honestly, when we did this, was that the best return on dollar of the three different ways that people use this was the extended learning time, which I think is an interesting, again, only because there was only a certain amount of money at each school, $40,000, right? So if you have $40,000, how are you going to use that to best move? And the results would tell us that the extended learning time was a strong return on investment. Focus and, okay, so this is about that. So it was $4 million for that. We're asking for $0 for that in the 15-17 session. But we are asking for $4 million in support of focus and priority schools, and I'll get into that in a minute, but not for this reading opportunity necessarily, but to continue to provide our work to focus and priority schools. Again, we think that it was a good investment, but if you're going to compare it to continuing the work with focus and priority schools, there's really no comparison about which is the more important choice. Okay. Regional STEM Hub Grant. This was $2.86 million, and it funded hubs that were made up of 48 school districts, 4 post-secondary institutions, and community-based organizations. In Oregon, science, technology, engineering, and math, STEM, includes high-wage, high-demand job work. Emerging sectors need a STEM-skilled workforce, and advanced manufacturing, precision agriculture, food processing, healthcare, and highly skilled trades such as welding, construction engineering, and natural resource trades. The hubs help bridge pockets of excellence in STEM education programs, and they capture and share the best practices and resources and bring communities together around the local assets that they have. And the hubs are part of a longer-term strategy to make Oregon education and economic development systems more effective and serve their local students, communities, and industries. We also had a grant that was STEM, CTE, and STEAM grant. It was $2.45 million. It went to 8 districts and 5 community-based organizations, 2 post-secondary institutions. And their target was to deliver opportunities to underserved STEM students. And the definition of underserved here is a little bit different when we start to talk about STEM. We're talking about rural, girls, and students of color. And so that's a little bit different than some of our definition, because just to broadly say girls is different when we talk about underserved, but not necessarily when we talk about STEM and STEAM. And so this really was about targeting delivery of opportunities to those students. It included things like an environmental science experience in Harney County. They put together a trailer that gave an opportunity for students to have that experience that traditionally would not otherwise. The tiny house construction alternative high school work in Canby. So they're building tiny houses. You've seen sort of the move toward tiny houses. And what a great thing for a STEM program to get involved in, because the construction materials are minimal and the experience of figuring out all the things that go into building a house is the same.
I bet we could even teach girls to pump their own gas.
And tech geometry and tech algebra at Benson High, CTE, welding labs in John Day in Ontario, and STEM after school in Neocony and Woodburn. The STEM Lab Schools grant was $2 million, 7 school districts, 7 schools in 3 districts, and promoted opportunities for STEM experiences for teachers and students from across the state. So lots of different opportunities around STEM specifically in those schools. The Early Literacy Grant was a $1.8 million grant awarded to 26 institutions, including hubs, CBOs, libraries, Head Starts, and OneESD. Lots of children involved. Key deliverables to date are professional development for child care providers, professional development for parents and primary caregivers, structured story time activities, like 12,179 early literacy consultations provided by primary care physicians. So this is really about going out and working around literacy, early learning, where literacy can be provided within the early learning world. 38,211 books have been distributed through this program to young children. The Early Learning Professional Development Grant, also a pretty small grant at $400,000. Clearly, early learning is important. It makes a big difference in outcomes for students. And yet often, child care providers have little or no college work. And they're spending their time full-time caring for children. Tuition costs are high, more than they can afford. And these funded projects provide scholarship classes during times and locations that are convenient for the working student or for the person who is providing child care. And articulation between community colleges and universities so that the certificates and degrees are portable and stackable, which is really important. We talked about that a little bit yesterday. And in just a few short months, we have really nice results. 5 community colleges and 3 universities and lots of community partners working together to create curricula, degrees, and certificate. Over 450 early learning professionals are attending college classes in early childhood education, 450. Over 3,000 early childhood education college credits have been earned. 64 credits have been awarded, 2 degrees completed, and Southern Oregon University is offering Saturday workshops for college credit and professional development. So there's just lots of really good stuff going on there out of those dollars. Slide 70 is the Advanced Placement International Baccalaureate grant. This was $3 million that went to 96 school districts, impacted 153 schools, and the idea here was to use these resources to pay for students to take the AP, the Advanced Placement courses, and the IB, International Baccalaureate, not the courses, the assessment, so to take the test. So child signs up to take a class in a really advanced class in either Advanced Placement or International Baccalaureate. There's a cost associated with the test. We put this together on a sliding scale basically around poverty so that students who were in poverty got it paid for. Students who had some resources got the majority, much bigger majority of it paid for, but not all of it in every case. And our hope is that what we'll see is an increase in the numbers of students who are taking AP and IB exams. When you look at the result here, I don't see a big bump between 12-13 and 13-14. In fact, 119 more students. Certainly, we need to continue to publicize this. Students are currently taking those tests right now, AP and IB, and so we'll see what kind of a bump we get in test taking in the 14-15 school year. This shows a long history of that, and I think one of the more interesting things for me in looking at this chart is that in 2002 we had 425 assessments taken, and last year we had 6,129. I hope that trajectory will continue.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So as I look at that, Rob, I appreciate the goal the funding is attempting to achieve. Do we have schools encouraging maybe not the typical AP class students to take an AP class?
Co-Chairs Coffman Monroe, Representative Springer, it's a great question. Yes, certainly. I'm aware of specific schools that have done really targeted work around that. I'm thinking of Woodburn in particular is just one that jumps to my mind. And some of the conversations I had with a number of superintendents about this particular grant as it was coming out and how we could get it out most effectively so that it could impact their children and their conversations with students who are in poverty about this as an opportunity, and that you need to know you can take the test for free, and this should not be a barrier to your participating in these classes, and the direct communication about that. I don't know the answer to that on a statewide level.
Follow up, Mr. Co-Chair. I would love to see, if we can get there, some data that shows us socioeconomic status of students taking these classes. I just don't know that we have enough broad-based encouragement in all of our school districts. It's great to address the cost driver, but I think it is actually more imperative that we get kids in those classes.
Co-Chairs Compton Monroe, Representative Springer, I would find that data interesting as well, I bet. As I did a couple of pieces we produced yesterday, I will ask and see if we can get that for you, and I will communicate to you whether we can or cannot to all the committee. It may be data that we don't have. If we do, we'll certainly produce it.
Okay. Madam Co-Chair.
I would just comment for people that haven't been involved in the International Baccalaureate program, and when you see that there's a negative 8.5%, the International Baccalaureate, you have to pay like a subscription cost every year, and I think it's like, well, in 1998 it was like 10 grand, and then the actual assessments are also very expensive. And speaking for Woodburn, because there's not very many international baccalaureate schools in the state. I don't know how many there are now, but there used to be in the 90s only 7. There were South High and Lincoln, and when Woodburn applied, everybody laughed at us, and we were accepted on our second application process, and yeah. That was back in 98, and I know my colleagues here have heard me make this statement. This year we have 34 students taking the entire six exams, which is a really high number of taking the full exams, but they will literally go into college anywhere in this world as a sophomore if they pass all six of those exams. So it's quite a marathon endurance test for any student as their senior year. They probably don't have a girlfriend, haven't seen a movie, anything other than study. And so, you know, when school districts have to make these decisions, and my advocacy for AP is just as high as IB, because they it's really important. It gets them off to that right foot. What they need when they pass these exams, they know they're college ready, and that's and yet sometimes the expense, as Representative Springer shared with looking at the socioeconomic status. We were always lucky in Woodburn because our school board said, we don't care what the cost is, we're going to invest in it. And I mean, that's a hard decision for a board and a superintendent to recommend. So,
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chairman Rowe. Do all the kids in the state take the TAG test at some point?
Co-chairs Compton and Rowe, Representative Taylor. No, not all students take a TAG test, but all students do take, well, we hope all students do take the summative assessment, which has been the OAKS. And when students mm-hmm. do take it and they demonstrate a certain score, mm-hmm. Then school districts begin to investigate and provide that opportunity so that they know whether or not the student, so, as a methodology to begin to identify TAG. There are lots of ways to do it, but that's one that everyone has in common.
Go ahead. Follow up.
So thank you, Chairman Rowe. So the reason I'm asking that is just following up on what Representative Springer was saying, because we, you know, of course, there are smart kids all across the state, and I always worry that we're not tapping into them for a variety of reasons, and maybe they don't have moms like us and or whatever. And so is there ever, I don't know if you're allowed to do this, or is there ever an attempt to kind of look at students who may be doing well on those tests but maybe aren't necessarily getting straight A's, but they have the potential, and then trying to direct them into being in an IP, you know, being in an IB program or taking AP tests?
Co-chairs Compton and Monroe, Representative Taylor, yes. The idea that the grades that students receive, like an A or a B, educators recognize can often be about having really good school-going habits mm-hmm. and not necessarily about talent and gift. Mm-hmm. And so working to identify, there are a lot of ways. It can be a teacher recommendation. Mm-hmm. It could be results off of the OAKS assessment or now Smarter Balanced. It could be A's and B's. There's a lot of different ways to identify talent and gift, mm-hmm. and we try to implement all those across the state in order to identify kids like that and get them what they need. Mm-hmm. I think one of the remarkable things, there were two fewer schools, by the way, that were AP, IB, from 1 year to the next when we got the minus on here. So two schools dropped away from that. I think one of the most remarkable things about Woodburn having gone straight IB is just the message that it sent to their community and to their kids, which is we have really high expectations, and we know that your innate brain capacity is at least that of every other child in the state. The advantage that you bring to school, maybe less. Mm-hmm. And your mom might think it is walking to the moon to show up at school, but we're going to change that. We're going to invite you. And we're going to tell your kids that they are capable of anything they desire. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they have a huge number of kids that are taking the full IB battery, that's more than Tigard and Tualatin High School will have this year put together. It's a really remarkable feat. And Tigard Tualatin's really good at IB. They really are. They so my old high schools did that, and they're
the
really
initial,
good at
yeah,
it. Probably
the
state,
ones,
one of the
yeah.
state leaders, Lincoln. Yeah. That I just think it's an incredible... it was an incredible leap for them to make that decision, and one that tells what they think, tells what they believe about kids and their capacities, one that we could all learn from.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chairman Rowe. Sorry, last question, I promise. So following up on that, so what can we do to, you know, to expand that? Because although I do think parents obviously have to have a responsibility and I don't want to put everything on the schools, I would venture to bet that a lot of the folks that are participating or have their children participating in this is being driven by the family decision. I'm worried that it's right. too much of that and maybe could be more of what you're saying in the perhaps the Woodburn examples.
Co-chairs Compton Rowe, Representative Taylor, thank you for the softball. I mean, the idea is that you have to believe that all kids are capable of achieving at a really high level. So you probably ought to adopt a set of standards that has all kids have to target that level. It's mm-hmm. the Common Core. It's part of why the Common Core is so incredibly important to our overall health, is you have to say we're going to set a set of really high standards that most people don't think that kids can achieve. Right? Most people didn't think that kids could achieve the level of IB in Woodburn. And part of the problem is when we don't give kids access to content, we doom them to their future. So the bottom line is, if I don't ever teach it to you, how can I expect you to know it? And then give you a test and prove that you don't know it. And we do that when kids take the ACT and the SAT because they never had access to the content they needed to learn in order to be able to pass the test at a high enough level to get accepted to college. So you have to set a college and career ready level of standards so that all kids have access to the high levels of content and are taught what they need in order to be successful as adults. That is a bitter, tough pill to swallow. It's hard to do. We're in the middle of that. And it's going to be really interesting to see whether or not we have the guts to hang on. Because we're going to tell some parents that their kids didn't learn everything that they needed to in order to be college and career ready, and it's going to be an honest assessment.
And we have to convince a few legislators of that, too. Okay, we have about 30 slides to go, and we have about 15 minutes.
So. I'm going to do it. Okay. Get off my high horse, although I enjoyed that spot for just a second. student mentoring, monitoring, and acceleration, and what I'm going to do is perhaps really push on some of the smaller grant awards. But this one was $3.3 million, and it really was about how do we support some of our students who have typically had a really hard time being successful in school in English, language, arts, math, and science. And it was critical to changing the path these students moving forward. I think one of the great events that I got to attend and speak at 2 years ago was the Black Student Success Summit that came out of this, and this really was bringing together black professionals from across the state and presenting a workshop day with black students from across the state and say, here's an example of an architect, an engineer, a doctor, a lawyer, a teacher, policeman, and your dreams are possible. And so they had that opportunity. There was some mentoring that was set up. The attendees were pretty wild about this. I love this graphic, but it just talks about what the kids said about the workshop after having attended. I love in the lower right-hand corner that says, quote, so many black professionals, engineers, biologists, lawyers, politicians, I felt like I was sitting in a room and I belong here. Pretty cool. And so those kinds of opportunities for kids. Another way that this was used was this student mentoring. McMinnville did eighth grade academies for students who needed some additional support and reduced their Algebra 1 failure rate. They did ninth grade smaller learning communities and had some of the highest attendance rates and on track for graduation rates. 90% on track for graduation. 4 years from now, McMinnville's graduation rate, it's already good, is going to be sort of off the hook. The TEL grant, this is a $255,000 grant. I think I've talked about this quite a bit. I'll probably move quickly here. But it really is about asking educators what it's like to be an educator in the state of Oregon and what support you might need, what we can learn from this. About 60% of those eligible responded. I think that rate will go up over time. It's something we would give every 2 years, and so we would need biennial funding in order to be able to do that. We didn't do it this year. We would like to do it next year. And it will tell us about how teachers are being supported and educators are being supported and what they need in order to be at their very best within the profession. So I think it's a valuable thing. This is just a map of the response rate that we had there, and then the cost, and how that moves forward. This 78, and please stop me if you have any questions, stop me, and I'll, or otherwise I'm going to power. A fairly small grant, $600,000, and it was, this is really to encourage increasing the percentage of teachers of color in the state. It's a strong focus on the cadet teacher model, where students as early as middle school have the opportunity to explore the teaching profession through theory, practice, mentorship, and inquiry. You can see that 35.3% of our students are students of color in the state today. If we don't, by the way, close achievement gaps, we've got a big, big, big problem here. And only 8.3% of educators are educators of color. This is an effort to change that dynamic and have educators that look like the students that they serve.
That is a critical problem.
Big problem. Big problem. And I worry sometimes about getting there. Part of the issue is that the adult population is a much smaller percent of people of color, just to start with, right? And so to balance that up, you have to actually have an over-representation of educators, of adults move into the education profession, which is rough. And so being targeted about that and having a program that does that's an important thing to do.
But to tell 35% of our kids you can accomplish anything you want, and then have them in classrooms with all white instructors, or vast majority, is kind of, what do we say, you know, do what I do, don't do what I say kind of attitude. We're really not showing them that they can be anything they want.
College and Career Ready Assessments was a $1 million grant. It was a training opportunity around high quality works, what we call work samples. It is like a interim set of test questions, basically, and it would be demonstrating writing and large math problems. And the UCLA supported us in this, one of their schools of education. And we gave training to 4 school districts, teachers, and they developed these high-quality professional development. They got technical support from, it's called BEAR, which is the UCLA research area that helped us with this. And they created 90 work samples each in reading, writing, and math. And those will now be housed on our network and available for all teachers to use. And it's a really important part of NICE assessment in the state that can help us know what students are learning, and that have them demonstrate that. The Oregon Educator Network really is the network. It is what I've been talking about, this receptacle for pouring all this information into. $300,000, all school districts participated in this, and again, it's going to be hosted at Willamette ESD and provide our educators access to what we have developed. Proficiency-based teaching and learning was a $700,000 award to provide support for proficiency-based learning. About $500,000 of that went to the Business Education Compact. We provided support for 4 districts and 3 ESDs in proficiency-based methodologies. Organizational assessments, $300,000, and it really went for these 4 school districts to have an assessment of their organization and work on being more productive. It's a model we wanted to look at and see if it's something we could scale up across the state. So they basically get organizational feedback and make changes in the way they operate. Teaching Oregon Resigning Teacher Prep Programs. This was supported redesign of teacher preparation, allowed pre-service teachers to have a richer experience in student teaching and support to improve their practices. They exit college. Pre-service teachers receive mentoring, support through a strong college-district partnership where districts weighed in with colleges on what knowledge and experiences they wanted teachers to have before they were going to hire them. I've talked to some of the superintendents who participated in this, and they just absolutely loved it. The look that they got at the educators, and then working with them about this is what it means to be a teacher in Tillamook, and the way that we go about things, and making sure that they had pre-service about that as a likely Tillamook teacher, and the affinity that it gives to some of these smaller districts toward working there is really important. So we have a few other funding proposals I need to hit that are things that we are seeking. So there is a GED initiative, $2 million to provide support for GED attainment for students age 17 to 25 that don't have a high school diploma. And the resources could serve up to 50,000 students starting this July. The pilot preparation programs are administered by CBOs, and they provide students with grants for training and testing. We're asking for this initiative in an effort to increase the number of students who earn a GED by providing the support through those community-based organizations.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Wilson? We're looking to see if Mr. Saxon's available, if we're still not sure, but I'd rather have, I think it's useful to hear these without being on the accelerated rate. So my suggestion would be go a few more minutes and then we'll carry over till tomorrow, and hopefully by then we'll hear from your staff whether you're available at some time in this time slot, because I'd rather not have you hurry.
Meeting?
Yes.
Chairman Rowe, Mr. Wilson, I am available tomorrow morning. I just looked at my calendar, so that would be great.
Representative Springer.
I appreciate that very much, because as we look at this, how will the program work? How are we going to get students in to the program? Maybe I'm wrong, but I think it's my perception that one of the barriers to getting a GED is not so much the cost of the test. The first barrier is not the cost of the test. The first barrier is that's a lot of work, or how do I do that? And so is this money solely allocated for costs, or is this money that's allocated to encourage students to get a GED?
Chairman Rowe, Representative Springer, I can bring that answer to you back tomorrow. My understanding is that one of the issues with GED is that we have children who have, or young adults who have exited the school system, they're just out there, right? So it's not something that it makes sense to say, hey, Taft High School, why don't you connect with 24-year-olds out in the community who need a GED? And so part of the effort here, and that's why the community-based organizations are a really big part of this, is because they're community-based, and it makes it a lot easier to reach out and identify those students who need that kind of support, or those people, I shouldn't call them students, those people who are in the community that did not receive a diploma who need those kinds of supports, and give them to them and an encouragement around achieving a GED. I'll find out the exact distribution that's been recommended and bring that back to you tomorrow.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
That'd be great, because as you said that, I'm thinking, okay, they're out of high school, so this isn't a high school issue. So this is a community issue, and who is or what is the process that says, hey, you really need to do this. This is what that GED can do for you. I've just never heard anybody say, and I've talked to a lot of folks trying to get them back to school, I've never heard anybody say, but the cost of the test is high. I've never heard that statement.
Right, and Chairman Rowe, Representative Springer, I think that's part of there are some dollars around that, but really this is about supporting the community-based organizations, providing them with some resources to go out and do the work, and not necessarily for the child to take the test, although that's, I believe, part of it. There are a couple really good reports that we had on GED that came out in the last biennial. One was out of the Secretary of State's office, I believe, and the other one was by the City Club of Portland on GED and the GED issue and what might be possible, and some recommendations about how we could do this work. And this particular request comes out of those recommendations.
Yeah, I'm interested in, there's a spectrum of GED programs. I mean, it's not all cookie cutter. I know there are programs in virtually every community college, but I'm interested in maybe you telling us a little more about what some of the options are for getting a GED, and how those programs are alike and how they differ. And I think we'll probably go ahead and break at this point and let Mr. Saxon do his homework and come back and spend a few minutes with us tomorrow. So I will carry over House Bill 5016. Mr. Wilson.
So I'm not sure the order for tomorrow, Mr. Chair, members. There are at least two other bills. We have four bills scheduled. Two of them are fee bills. They all four bills deal with HECS private career school and their diploma or degree authorization office. We're looking at a couple of bills that we may pull off because we're still waiting for some information. So we should have time to deal with this if we pull those two off.
So we'll plan on, what, 20 minutes or so tomorrow to finish this?
Or what it takes.
Something in that neighborhood, and then deal with the other work that we have to do. Any questions for Mr. Wilson or anything for the order, Senator Roblin?
So it appears we do have a Ways and Means on Friday, though, albeit short, or is it going to grow?
My understanding, Mr. Chair, Senator Roblin, that is going to be a short agenda. I think there's three or four budget-related bills and then a couple of the grants, including one you just heard. But they are keeping the agenda short.
Okay.
Yeah, I was told a half an hour, but
somewhere
in that neighborhood.
Appreciate that.
O'clock. Representative Springer.
Well, for the good of the order, Mr. Co-Chair, I would just offer to teach anybody how to pump gas. I learned in the mid-80s when I became a cop, and so I'm more than willing to assist anybody that wants to learn how to pump gas.
I'll take you up on that. No.
Well, it is interesting. Of course, Oregon is one of, what, two states that doesn't allow self-serve gas, and the polling has always been overwhelmingly men are in favor of self-serve, women are against it. And since there's more women than there are men, it gets voted down every time. But it's an interesting dilemma. The problem is when you go out of state, then you have to pump your own gas pretty much. And my wife left her gas cap off one time, and we had to drive back.
Alrighty, I think
together.
We're good. I think we're good here.
Okay, we are in recess until tomorrow.